You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB Local News for Monday, November 2nd, 2020.
Later in the program, WFHB correspondent Katrine Bruner reports on the record number of early voters in Indiana. More than 1.5 million people voted early so far. Katrine Bruner has more coming up later in the show.
So the quickest way is to go online on indianavoters.in.gov.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we have A Few Minutes with the Mayor, a weekly segment where we talk to Mayor John Hamilton about community issues. That's coming up in today's feature report. But first, your local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Monday, November 2nd. I'm Aaron Comforti. The Indiana State Department of Health reported almost 3,100 new COVID-19 cases today. That's the state's fourth highest count on record. Indiana is averaging just under 3,000 new cases per day, and that is the state's record high. 26 new COVID-related deaths were added to Indiana's tally today. That's right in line with the state's average for new deaths. There are 1,759 Hoosiers currently hospitalized because of COVID-19. That's the most people hospitalized since early April. Locally, Monroe County recorded 25 new cases, a bit under its average, and the county's second new COVID-related death in a week. Owen, Morgan, and Jackson counties each saw 28 new cases today. Other surrounding counties saw between 2 and 10. Last week, Indiana University reported 99 new cases of COVID-19 at its Bloomington campus. That's a slight uptick from the previous week. And schools in Indiana saw more than 1,300 new cases of COVID-19 last week. 65% of new school cases were children. And early voting is officially over, but last week, Monroe County officials managed to rebuff the efforts of concerned citizens who called an emergency court hearing to advocate for the opening of additional early voting locations. As WFHB has previously reported, lines at Monroe County's only early voting location stretched for 4 or 5 blocks, and wait times were consistently between 1 and 3 hours. The concerned citizens, who were not part of an organization, claimed that the long wait times at the county's only early voting location were in effect voter suppression, because long wait times prohibited working people who couldn't get time off from voting. The citizens noted that neighboring Lawrence County, with a third the population of Monroe County, had 2 early voting places. Monroe County officials have not commented publicly on the subject. That's your local news brief from WFHB. I'm Aaron Comforti.
Monroe County Health Administrator Penny Caudill said daily increase of positive COVID-19 cases were seen last week. She spoke during the October 30th COVID-19 press conference.
You know, we've seen 60 cases a day. Now, those days, we have also had large number of tests done. So while the positivity rate may look smaller, those are still cases that indicate the virus is circulating in our community at a level that we really don't want it to be circulating at. When we look at our cases per 100,000, they are higher than we want them to be. They're over 100, and we want them, like, under 10 is what we really want.
Caudill mentioned travel across county lines could increase the virus spread. Deputy Director of Emergency Management Kate Petroline reported Red Cross blood drive donation availability through March of 2021.
Monroe County government, in partnership with the Red Cross and the Monroe Convention Center, has decided to offer one drive a month that will be in the evening. And we can foresee that through March of 2021. Sounds crazy to say 2021, but it's coming soon. But for November, the evening date would be November 19th from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. And then the day date is actually a few days earlier on November 9th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. You can reserve a slot by going onto redcross.org's website, and you can click on a time and a date of which you would like to give blood, or you can find more details on our website at co.monroe.in.us.
Indiana University Assistant Vice President for Strategic Partnership, Kirk White, said students responsible for holding unsafe football game celebrations will be held responsible. He mentioned transmission was a high risk at some gatherings.
Four of the parties or large gatherings that were reported to Indiana University Police violated our policies, and we will identify those who are responsible for organizing them, and they will go through the university disciplinary process. Some people have described these large events as a kind of coronavirus crockpot, where things slowly cook and then we see the results later. So we'll be watching the mitigation testing results really from yesterday, today, and early next week, which would be about the 5 to 6 day average time after infection that you would start to show symptoms. And if we see upticks, we'll know exactly what kind of impact these impromptu celebrations cause.
Caudill said family and close contacts are at greatest risks of transmission. White said both departure and returning COVID-19 testing will be available for students leaving in November and arriving next semester.
The Monroe County Commissioners approved a one-day Black Lives Matter Bloomington training for elected officials. County Attorney Jeff Cockerell spoke about the costs during their October 28th meeting.
It's been determined that this will be a virtual meeting, which leads to a slight addition in cost. Also, since it's virtual, some of the insurance language didn't make as much sense. The liability for a online meeting is much less to nil than if it were to be an in-person meeting that they are performing at. The insurance requirements for, you know, workman's comp and things have not changed, but just the liability insurance has changed for that reason. This is a training that is currently scheduled for January 30th for elected officials to go and be trained by Black Lives Matters on certain matters that they have expertise on, and that is the reason for the training.
Commissioner Julie Thomas mentioned the training would occur after the election to include newly elected officials. Commissioner Penny Githens said the total cost would be $6,250. Also during the county commissioner meeting, Cockerell proposed personnel policy handbook changes.
There are three changes to our policy, idea changes to our policy incorporated in this. One is to change sick leave to personal benefit time to give a little more flexibility in scheduling and use of the benefit time we give. The second is to change our bereavement time to make it coincide more with other major employers in the area and kind of give it a more understandable, I think, who gets what for when. And then the third was the training. We added some required training language, and I think we had gotten some feedback that that may be somewhat problematic.
Cockerell said language was proposed to make more straightforward changes to the code section of competent and inclusive workforce. He clarified the Board of Judges and prosecutor have not yet approved the language.
Clarify some of the concepts in there is that, you know, there are some trainings that everybody has to do, and those are the examples used in this are computer usage training and internal control trainings. I think also from time to time we have trainings that are requested by the insurance carriers that help keep our insurance rates down, and other kind of, I'm thinking sexual harassment training, things like that that are universally necessary in order for us to do those things. Those are ones that the Board of Commissioners can say, hey, we've got to do this because it either has a usage, and at the end of the day, all these have a liability or state requirement behind it, policy. Subject matter training are by the overseeing elected officials. The reason that is excluded from that the law enforcement is excluded from the second set is because that is a subject matter competency training for the law enforcement employee. They have to go through that, and the sheriff decides that. So in essence, that becomes under that clause.
Commissioners unanimously approved the policy changes.
City Councilman Jim Sims presented the establishment of a Community Advisory on Public Safety Commission. He spoke of the commission responsibilities during the October 28th Bloomington City Council Public Safety Committee meeting.
This commission would, among other duties, research and make recommendations to the Common Council and the mayor on matters of public safety.
Sims mentioned 11 members would form the commission. Councilmember Isabel Piedmont-Smith said the committee would contain many demographics.
And there are some demographic groups that don't have a seat at the table, especially when making decisions on public safety, even though issues of public safety affect them greatly due to various forms of bigotry, prejudice, and systemic bias. And so this is really a mechanism for us to hear those voices. We propose the formation of the Community Advisory on Public Safety Commission, CAPS, to hear these voices, specifically their recommendations for improving public safety in our community.
Piedmont-Smith stated, the commission would review and propose successful programs from other communities and create new programs. She clarified the City Council Public Safety Committee would review all applicants and the council at whole would vote on appointments. Board of Public Safety member Makwibe Reese brought up concerns of commission formation.
I wanted to say something as it relates to what Councilwoman Piedmont-Smith mentioned. I hear her say that she wants to empower the people as it relates to including people at the table. However, in this CAPS commission, those individuals, Black, Indigenous, people of color, in their intersections, were not part of the conversation in creating this piece, this CAPS piece. And that's my number one concern, because not only do we, Black, Indigenous, people of color in their intersections want a seat at the table, but we also want to create that table and we want other people to join our table. And that's what I would suggest as what the additional initiatives are supporting is us actually creating that table and encouraging people to join that seat at the table. And something that I share with both, with all the sponsors, including the organizers, was my concern about not having people of color, Black, Indigenous, in their intersections as part of this conversation, and that it is considered white-centered.
Piedmont-Smith said if she were to do it again, she would have included more demographics earlier. She stated law enforcement on the commission would drown out other voices.
Well, the police hold the power. The police, you know, are funded, are trained, are armed. They hold the power. And we want to hear from people who don't hold power. So I think that power dynamic is the reason why it would prevent us from hearing from people who do not hold the power and who have been marginalized if we had people from the police on this commission.
Sims said he would rather see the commission begin as a focus group. Council member Kate Rosenbarger mentioned a safe space and sense of commitment is created with a commission opposed to a focus group. Committee members will hold a second hearing on November 12th.
In Tech for Progress, a partnership with Vote Safe Indiana, Lessonly Anvil, and Common Cause said its top priority is to make sure all votes are counted. The group said it will deploy technology to protect the integrity of this year's election in Indiana. It's a nonprofit organization with a mission to organize motivated people in Indiana's tech community to be more engaged politically. According to Inside Indiana Business, the group developed the technology to track wait times at polling sites across the state. Founder and CEO Roger Dietz talked about his vision for InTech for Progress to Inside Indiana Businesses.
I've long been interested in getting the tech community more engaged politically, and this year felt like a really important year to make something happen. And so we started InTech for Progress with a vision that we could help out in this year's election, but then eventually we could be motivating members of our tech community who have skills and resources that could really apply to civic projects and make change.
Dietz discussed how he gathered a variety of organizations together to collaborate on this project.
So I've been a longtime friend of the founder of Vote Safe Indiana, and we were discussing some ideas for how the tech community could apply their skills and resources to help out in the election. And meanwhile, Lesson Lee also had raised their hand and wanted to help and got the idea to build a website for reporting voting times. But we knew we were going to need data to power that site, and we knew we were going to need to enable technology to those volunteers to submit that data. So between Lesson Lee and Vote Safe Indiana and InTech for Progress and then Anvil, we started to work up the idea for bringing all these different pieces together so we could report on the vote times.
He breaks down how users can check to see an estimated wait time before heading to their polling site. He also approximated how many people have used InTech for Progress.
Yeah, it's been really it's really resonated with the community. Some of our numbers over the past few days, we've had around 36,000 folks visiting the site. I hear lots of stories, just word of mouth, people saying that they've used it in their voting. We know that we have nearly 200 volunteers that came in to help report those times. We've had a massive influx in volunteers over the past few days. So it's really reached adoption quickly.
Dietz said he hopes this project will be a catalyst to better engage the tech community in the voting process.
So clearly the idea is resonating now. We feel like this is something that could be taken statewide and even beyond. And from the tech community's perspective, you know, we're collecting a lot of data here that we think can be used then to influence public policy going forward. And I know that we have a ton of folks in the tech community interested in being more engaged. And so I think showing the success of this first project will really build momentum to work on future projects.
Monroe County Election Central has seen long lines since early voting kicked off earlier this month. The last chance to vote is in person on Tuesday at your respective polling site. Voting sites will be open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Tuesday.
With an update on where, when, and how to vote, if you haven't done so already, we turn to WFHB correspondent Katrine Bruner.
This year has been one for the records in the United States for many things, but specifically on the status of early voting. Data was taken on October 30th by the U.S. Elections Project, showing a total of 82 million votes cast whether by mail or in person nationwide. Looking back at the 2016 presidential election, early votes totaled to only 56 million in the U.S. It seems that the pandemic is certainly one of the driving forces behind this surge, but other reasons could apply as well. In 2016, the percent of 18 to 29-year-olds voting was 46, and this year, some polls are estimating at least 63% participation from young voters. In Indiana, more than 1.5 million Hoosiers have voted early, according to the Washington Post. That's more than two times the total amount of early votes from 2016. As of Monday, President Donald Trump leads 11 points ahead of his candidate for Indiana, according to data from 538. The last day for Monroe County residents to vote early was today. As of Saturday, already more than 22,000 Monroe County residents have casted their ballots. Only one location was available for early voting at Monroe County Election Central, 401 West 7th Street. Tomorrow is Election Day, and Monroe County will have 28 polling places open to vote at. It is important to know how, when, and where to vote, because unlike early voting, Monroe County voters cannot all go to the same place. Each person must go to their assigned polling place on Election Day. If you are unsure where to go, you can find a map on the Monroe County Geographic Information System Division to see which precinct is the right one for you. The next step is to find where your polling place is. Polls will be open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. The Bloomington Transit will be running 15 to 20 minutes after 6 a.m. to get people to their nearest polls. For WFHB, I'm Katrine Bruner.
Up next, we have this week's edition of A Few Minutes with the Mayor. On today's segment, we ask Mayor Hamilton about local COVID-19 restrictions, the city's 16th positive coronavirus case, and where residents can find their voting sites on Election Day. All that and more in today's A Few Minutes with the Mayor. Community members posted questions on our social media via Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, posing questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about current issues. Today, on A Few Minutes with the Mayor, John Hamilton answers these questions. As the COVID-19 case numbers continue to rise, is there any city consideration of travel restrictions like what is seen in Chicago to keep the virus out of the local area?
You know, Sydney, we've had some people asking about that because Bloomington and our community are doing better than the state as a whole, quite significantly. I have to tell you, I don't know what we're allowed to do on that. We are starting to look at that. But I also feel like it's pretty clear that we can't be an island. We have so many people who come in and out of town for work, for in healthcare services and others. We have so many students who will be returning home around Thanksgiving. So I think it's a good question. I think what I would say is really, it's just a reminder of how important it is to know that even if things are going well in Bloomington, we have to be very careful and keep up our guard and keep up our good behaviors that are really helping Bloomington do better than the rest of the state. We will look at that, but I think it's a really tough thing to try to accomplish as a community like us.
Is there a possibility that the city could shut back down as seen in May and earlier months of this year?
Whether or not we might need a stay-at-home order for the community is a good question. You know, city government never shut down. We've continued to operate 24/7 every day of this year. And I want to thank all of our employees for the incredible way they've stepped up to keep collecting garbage and run water plants and patrol our streets and protect our residents and all those things. You know, if the numbers around the state keep getting worse, and you need to remind people, we need to remember that we've almost tripled the daily case average in the last 30 days or so, and the death rate has basically doubled also. So those are very concerning numbers. That's not what we've seen locally. But if that were to continue to deteriorate, we could see the state looking at a retrenchment and having to go backwards, which would make us look at that as well. But so far, the things that really seem to help are masks and physical distancing. And most of the transmission seems to be happening in small social gatherings. So it just means we do need to keep protecting against super spreader events. But let's try to keep doing the things we do to protect and get the good results we've been seeing in Bloomington.
Kind of leading into that with what you're saying about how the city is never shut down, the city of Bloomington reported their 16th positive COVID-19 test among city employees. What precautionary measures do the city staff take in order to prevent the spread of the virus?
Well, every city employee is working differently today than they were 10 months ago. Whether you're a firefighter or police officer or water plant operator or sanitation worker or street repair or animal control or parks, everybody is working differently. And a lot of that, we've had a group called our Continuity of City Government that's focused on how do we keep providing the services that are so important in the midst of this pandemic. And a lot of it's personal protective equipment, a lot of it's protocols like trying to reduce the number of people in one place at one time. The police department, for example, for a period of time, didn't have their regular shift meetings at the beginning of each shift. Our water department, the utility department, has been doing kind of double shift meetings. So there's a lot of protocols in place. And I think the good news is it doesn't appear that most of our employees who've gotten sick, the vast majority have not gotten sick on the job. They've gotten sick outside the workplace. And then, and frankly, it appears we've been able to basically not have it transmitted at work. Now, that's the general experience we've had. I'm happy to report as well that all the employees who've gotten sick have recovered. But 2% of our workforce getting sick is concerning, but it's, if you offered me that deal, that would be the case in the beginning of March, I would probably say that's a good performance, that we've been able to protect our employees who have to work so hard and in the public.
And so when someone tests positive, what are the steps to keep them isolated, or when can they come back to work?
Sure. We basically follow the CDC protocols, which mean if you get a positive test, you isolate. I don't know if it's 14 days now or exactly what the recommendations are from the CDC, but we follow that. We have very intense contact tracing to make sure we look at work, what might have happened. And if there's exposure that happened at work, then those people who were exposed also follow the CDC protocols to isolate. And again, we've been able to find so far that there has not really been significant transmission in the workplace so far, and we knock on wood. But we follow the CDC protocols for isolation, for contact tracing, and then testing, and symptom-free and disease-free for a certain number of days before they come back to work.
And the next question is, tomorrow is Election Day. How do you think tomorrow's election may be different than one seen before?
Well, first, make sure everybody votes. This is a good time to remind people the polls will be open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Election Day, Tuesday, November 3rd. So if you're registered, please do vote. We have seen an enormous amount of early voting this year, more than I think we've ever experienced, and that's good. It does remind us you got to be patient when Election Day is over, that we may not have the results as quickly as some people want to see or think we should see, because it takes time under law. You cannot open absentee ballots until the morning of Election Day, so it takes a lot of time to open the envelopes and scan the ballots and get those in. But I'm hoping we have high voter turnout. And of course, I'm a Democrat and I'm a proud progressive, and I hope we have significant change ahead of us after Election Day.
And where can residents find their voting locations, and what should they bring with them to vote?
So the quickest way is to go online on indianavoters.in.gov, and you can find your voting location, or if that doesn't work for any reason, just Google online for that. And I know you'll need a valid government-issued voter ID. I'm sorry that's the case in Indiana, but it is, according to state law. So bring a driver's license or another government-issued valid picture ID, and that should get you there. If you don't know where to go, check that site, because you do need to go to your own precinct. Also, unfortunately, that we don't have voting centers, but we don't have those yet. So you've got to get to the right precinct location to vote between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. on Tuesday. If you are in line before 6 p.m., you will be allowed to vote. You should be allowed to vote, even if it takes after 6 p.m., as long as you're in line by 6 p.m. And let's encourage everybody to get out and vote. This is a really important election.
Do you have a question for Mayor John Hamilton? Comment that question on this coming week's post for a few minutes with the mayor to have your question answered. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Aaron Comforti, Cade Young, and Sydney Foreman, in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Sydney Foreman.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Our engineer and executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming, online at WFHB.org.
You too can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for With Good Reason, coming up next on WFHB.